I mean, I wasn't thinking that way at all. I was just like, how soon can I get there? And how can I get out there and do this work? I mean, sure, I was insecure about, can I do it? Will I do a good job? I don't know that I was prepared. I'm not sure how prepared you can be.
As many news outlets shutter their four news bureaus, they've come to rely on freelance journalists, many of them local, to provide on-the-ground coverage of overseas news. Today, I talked to an award-winning foreign correspondent about how things have changed over the last two decades. I'm Michael O'Connell. This is It's All Journalism. The Neil Conan Prize for Excellence in Journalism is presented annually to a mid-career journalist doing extraordinary work in the spirit of the public good. This year's recipient is Jane Ferguson, foreign correspondent for PBS NewsHour and contributor to The New Yorker. She's here to talk about the award and her work. Jane, welcome to It's All Journalism.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, first of all, congratulations. You're actually the inaugural winner of the Neil Conan Prize, which Neil was a NPR journalist and producer since, you know, you work for PBS NewsHour. Did you know Neil?
Not personally. We had never met. He actually, you know, had stopped being a overseas correspondent full time, really kind of around about the time that I was sort of coming up. So we didn't overlap in the field, but I knew his work, of course.
Okay. So tell me a little bit about your background and you being a winning award for mid-career journalist, you must have done some journalism before this. What got you first interested in being a journalist?
Well, I grew up in Northern Ireland. I grew up in a very rural place in the midst of what was known as the Troubles back then, you know, a certain degree of sectarian conflict in this otherwise very beautiful part of the world. So I had this mixture of curiosity about, you know, what made people tick, about what made people commit acts of violence, about what divided people, what united them. And I had a lot of questions. You know, I was a kid growing up in a place where you weren't really encouraged to ask questions and have discussions about these things. I was also infected with a fair amount of wanderlust. I wanted to see the world and travel. I was fascinated by the world. I felt like I was growing up in the middle of nowhere and I wanted to see it all. And then, you know, 9/11 happened when I was a teenager in high school. And I had already known I wanted to be a journalist. I've been watching journalists on the TV for years and years, absolutely fascinated by the fact that there's a job out there where someone pays you to travel around the world and go and actually witness global events and talk to people for a living and see amazing things. So I've been watching those journalists, and then suddenly they were all, you know, covering conflict, and it seemed like the world was watching TV news in a way that I had not seen before, and I was absolutely drawn to it.
So what was it that drew you to covering conflicts as opposed to some other beat or form of journalism?
I do think that, you know, looking back, growing up in a certain degree of conflict tweaked a lot of curiosity. You know, I mean, I think that's the most important characteristic to have as a journalist, is to want to understand, to really want to see what motivates people at their best and at their worst. And these huge crises around the world, I wanted to understand what was causing them and what it was like for other people to live through them. You know, it's a sad reality that it is something that is universal. You know, wars in Europe, wars in the States, wars all around the world, like historically, it has blighted humanity for a very long time. And I think trying to get under the skin of it is something that deep down I've always been driven to understand.
Interesting. So what led to your current role as a foreign correspondent for PBS NewsHour?
Well, I had, you know, I was just talking to some students just now, earlier this morning at the university I was at in England, student journalists. And, you know, when I was your age, kind of a conversation, I was saying, you know, you don't know you're born now. It's so great. And I was like, there was a financial crisis just as I graduated college. And I had been really involved in student journalism. And I, you know, me and my colleagues, we just couldn't wait to my classmates. We were all going to run off and have these great careers and in London. And all I'd wanted to do was work for the BBC ever since I was a kid. And the financial crisis was so devastating to the British journalism industry. I mean, 2007, 2008, 2009. I mean, it was awful. And it was already struggling, you know, with declining, you know, revenue models as because of ads going online. And so I couldn't get a job. And one of the reasons I really, really wanted to write my book was to sort of help young people understand how much of success is defined by failure. At the risk of sounding like a kind of motivational speaker, you know, so many of the things that people looked at in my career as being choices were actually making the best of, you know, difficult situation. So I ended up being part of that first young wave, first generation of freelance journalists. You know, I mean, we didn't invent freelance journalism. People have been doing it for a long, long time. But we were really that first class where it became really common for mainstream media outlets to be using freelancers. And I moved to the Middle East really early, like pretty much, you know, just months after I left college. I ended up in Yemen studying Arabic. I managed to find a job at a newspaper in Dubai, an English language paper in the Middle East, which I did for a short while, but really I ended up freelancing out in the field for a long time for CNN, for Al Jazeera English. And then in 2015, I came to PBS. And that was an incredible fit for me. I'd done a lot of cable TV via Al Jazeera and CNN. So a lot of live reporting, a lot of traveling, a ton of rolling live coverage from places like Afghanistan and across the Arab Spring as well, all over the Middle East at an incredibly heady time. Just really, really optimistic, wild, exciting time in the Middle East. And then, you know, by the time I was pitching PBS and I approached them, I was living in Beirut. And I was really drawn to the fact that they were doing magazine length reporting. You know, I wanted to do longer, in-depth pieces. That was always my passion and always my intention. You know, every kiddo comes up thinking they're going to work for 60 minutes. And so the magazine length is the sweet spot of nuanced, gripping reporting to me. And that's why I stayed.
So you entered the industry when there were a lot of things going on with the industry. You know, everybody knows that the arrival of the internet kind of sort of blew up the journalism industry, and everybody had to learn new tools. Everybody was trying to master how to report news on Twitter or whatever. So it sounds like that was a, you know, a positive thing for you to be able to at that point sort of find a place where you could do long form journalism.
Yeah. I mean, I have been dragged into the 21st century kicking and screaming as a reporter. You know, I'm constantly described as old school, which is sort of odd because I'm just like, well, I'm just doing what I grew up wanting to do. I was a late adopter to social media and a reluctant one, and I'm now very rarely on Twitter at all. I certainly rarely tweet, but I might lurk to like check the news. But I was coming up at a time where my peers were really innovating. I remember during the Arab Spring, I remember during the revolution in Egypt, that like Twitter was a thing and people were starting to use this thing called Twitter, and they were like developing all these followers and being able to talk directly to them and break news and find out about breaking news. It really became a necessity to be able to do that. And to connect directly with people was really a novelty, you know, the ability to connect with the public without necessarily having this, you know, interim media organization.
I want to backpedal for a second. You went and reported from Gaza in 2014, and you've also, as you've been saying, covering other sort of stories in conflict zones. You know, I know that you sort of described to us your background and what interested you in this type of journalism. Was there any sort of preparation that you felt you needed to do before you could sort of enter a conflict zone and do that type of reporting?
I mean, I think when you're really young and you're finally getting out on the road and finally doing the job that you've dreamed of doing, I just don't know that I was in those early days thoughtful enough to even think that way. I was just so excited to get out and do the work, you know, and I wasn't thinking, well, what's this going to mean? I think the current younger generation are a lot more thoughtful. I know they are because I've taught journalism at university here, and they ask these questions. You know, I mean, at the time I wasn't thinking to myself, well, how do I prepare myself? And how do I also take care of my emotional health? And like, I mean, I wasn't thinking that way at all. I was just like, how soon can I get there? And how can I get out there and do this work? I mean, sure, I was insecure about, you know, can I do it? Will I do a good job? but I don't know that I was prepared. I'm not sure how prepared you can be, you know?
Yeah, until you're in it, until you begin to understand what's going on. I would imagine, you know, having moved to Yemen when you did and begin doing freelance work, that sort of changed your perspective a bit. I mean, now that you're in a mid, you know, level journalist, according to the presenters of this award, this prize, how do you see yourself as changed or different, do you think?
You mean as a professional? Or
as a professional, yeah, as a journalist.
Gosh.
or if you'd rather do it as a person, you can do that as well. But
yeah, in every way possible. You know, I mean, I think when you get to this stage of your career, and I think of the big differences between now and then when I was a kiddo starting out, first of all, I have the professional bandwidth to afford to do things more differently. I mean, the ability to be able to pick stories more if you can. I mean, I still need to get, you know, them approved by a foreign editor and the executives. But now I get to think a bit more about what it is that I want to cover and, you know, which stories would I do? Which do I think are additive? You know, I think that when you're a young reporter, there's a tendency to want to be where everybody else is. It took me over the years, I learned to go to where places are not being reported from. And in the early stages, I did that out of necessity. You know, if you want to sell a story to CNN and you're a kiddo and you're 25, you know, don't go to Baghdad. Everyone's there. They've got a fully stocked bureau. You know, go to Somalia and cover that. Go to Yemen back then when nobody was covering Yemen and do that. And I thought it would be better for my career to be off where all the other reporters were, you know, and in the tribe and where all of these senior journalists who I so admired would be. Over the years, I've realized that that ended up being my greatest strength, was being able to go to places that were undercovered. Now I don't view it through the lens of me and my career, as so often you do when you're young and you're trying to make it. Now I'm able to look at these stories and think, well, where can I be additive? Where would my reporting actually help fill a gap in global awareness or American awareness at the very least? And so that's why I tend to think of, you know, could I go to Sudan and cover the conflict there? Or, you know, would it be more helpful if I talk about, you know, this issue? I love that. And I see that as a privilege, being able to think bigger picture than me and my career. Because when you're young, it just all feels so fragile, you know, like you love the work. But you feel like if you took the weekend off, your career would collapse. And it's necessary, but it's unfortunate that you're so self-observing rather than thinking about, you know, the world and, you know, the stories and your input. And so that's what I love about this stage in my career, where I get to think way more in terms of public service.
So how does the audience figure into the types of stories you choose? You mentioned Americans, primarily American audience.
Well, for the news hour, certainly. And I mean, we broadcast in the United States. We're online on YouTube, so anyone can watch us. But we are an American public service. You know, I try not to let the audience, considerations of the audience, impact my reporting too much. Because, you know, we all see what that does to network news when it becomes about ratings. And you overthink, you know. I mean, I don't blame them. I understand they have a bottom line. They need to attract advertising dollars. And so there's more of a tightrope there. I must admit, working in non-for-profit news gives you an extraordinary freedom to do news that is considered a public service and not necessarily obsessed with the ratings. I mean, obviously, we want people to watch and we want people to like watching and we want them to feel like they're interested in these stories. But, you know, we're not constantly worried about, you know, the bottom line. Like, those who donate to public broadcasting are doing it because they want stories that matter, not because they want advertising dollars. And so that actually does, you know, that filters through to me in the field and my colleagues. You know, I think they probably feel the same way. You know, we get to think more about the story than worrying about how it's received in some ways.
Yeah, obviously, I'm not a foreign correspondent, but I've observed that, you know, if you do make that effort to cover something different, even though you know that there are other reporters covering the same general story or the same general area, that people do respond to that. If you're thoughtful about what you're writing and choosing the subject that interests you and sort of presenting, this is why I think it's important. I mean, people do respond to that.
Yeah. I give that advice to young reporters these days. You know, I say, look, you know, think of something original. Think of something that would grab your interest.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. What type of stories are you drawn to typically?
Well, I have, you know, it's funny watching patterns develop throughout your career, because so much of our lives and our professional work, I suppose, is all sort of subconscious. You start to see things that you were drawn to that you may not have purposely landed in to do. I've always been fascinated by looking beyond the front lines. You know, I wrote about this a little bit in my book that, you know, combat reporting, you know, the bang bang is kind of a blunt instrument. It's very easy to do. You just have to grit your teeth and try to, you know, not get too scared. But it's not really additive in terms of storytelling. You know, I've always been fascinated by how conflict impacts societies and communities. So I try to dig a little bit deeper into individual stories to really, really help audiences connect to characters. And that's been one thing I've absolutely loved doing, you know, finding someone who I can spend time with, whether it's a, you know, female doctor in Afghanistan or someone in Yemen, anywhere I go, you know, like especially in places like Iraq and Syria, find someone who's really interesting and thoughtful and return to them. I've absolutely loved doing that. Finding someone who my audience can connect to and going back and spending time with them again and again. And that really matters to me. And I think that's something that is sort of at heart, hopefully, good storytelling. The other thing that I've always focused on is, and it really became very clear to me in Yemen, that connection between conflict and humanitarian crisis. I mean, so much of conflict, we talk about casualty figures, those who have basically, you know, been injured or killed in a violent death on the front line. And it's always astonished me how much this just scratches the surface of what conflict does to people, and also how many people it kills in terms of malnutrition rates, in terms of the collapse of healthcare systems, the broader reach and the broader impact of conflict on communities and what it does to them really, really is something that I find it very important to talk about. You know, I lived in Beirut for a long time, and I was astonished to move there in 2014 and feel like, okay, this is almost 25 years since the end of the civil war there. And yet the country was still struggling so much in so many ways. I mean, in many ways it was, you know, it was a terrific place to live and I adored it. But to see how the legacy of conflict reaches into people's lives for generations was something that I wanted to figure out ways to tell that story, you know, because it's so big. And so that's kind of been where those two concepts meet, you know, finding characters through whom you can really help tell the broader story of what conflict's doing to the fabric of a community.
You know, a lot of people, if there's a conflict, if you go to the conflict ends, okay, well, that's the end of the story. But, you know, as you just said, those people who are there, whose lives and worlds were changed, you know, what about that story? Now they have to live with whatever the reality is, and as well as the memory. You know, how does that impact the way they interact with other people? What do they trust people? How do they raise their children?
It impacts everything. It impacts art. It impacts storytelling. You know, it gets into the fabric of absolutely everything. And it impacts, like, families, how they conduct themselves, where they live. It's just an endless alteration to people's lives that then becomes a part of their new life.
A couple of times on the podcast, we've talked about this idea of parachute journalism, where a reporter who comes from outside where the story's taking place parachutes in, interviews a handful of officials, writes their story, and then leaves without really talking to anybody on the ground who's directly impacted by the story. Is this something you've seen happening, or have things been changing?
I think it is, without meaning to hedge so much, both. You know, it's a growing problem for a lot of legacy news, like the networks. And it's not because people don't care so much as it's a financial reality of journalism today.
It's the resources.
It's the resources. We don't all have, I mean, I grew up with the BBC, where the BBC had a bureau, I mean, everywhere. You know, they had local reporters there, they had foreign reporters there, they had, of course, the big stars who would fly about. But generally speaking, you know, each country had someone who was living there and who could really get under the skin. That's just not a financial reality anymore. And so, you know, there is this sort of, you know, idea of the parachute journalism has been something that a phrase that people have used. I do think that sometimes those accusations of parachute journalism are sometimes kind of interlinked with the sense that you don't understand the story, which I do think can happen, of course. I mean, if you've got one person who's covering many, many, many countries, they'll never have the same nuanced view as a smaller region that they're specialist in. However, I would say that what we're starting to see more of now is a growth that I hope continues, however the media industry shakes out over these turbulent times, a growth in local journalists as well. You know, like when I was living in Beirut, there was a huge amount of foreign journalists and a fair lot of Arab journalists there too. You know, in Afghanistan, before the fall of Kabul, there was a really, really impressive homegrown local media industry where Afghan journalists were starting to write for Western newspapers and American papers and outlets. I think that that's going to continue. I think there'll always be a certain role for a foreign correspondent, you know, and this is a topic that I've discussed a lot with my colleagues. Like, is there ever really a reason for someone in New York City to fly out to somewhere and cover a story? I think there'll always be something there. They understand the audience that they're speaking to, perhaps very, very well. They have a specific story they want to cover. There'll always be people who are writing books, who are doing, like, you know, documentaries. I think day-to-day coverage will increasingly be taken on by local journalists. And I think that that's incredibly additive. There's one other element that I think a lot of people forget whenever we're covering a lot of the conflicts that we are, which is that, you know, there are times when our local colleagues cannot go on air because, especially with this creep of autocracy at the minute, it's always infinitely more dangerous for local journalists. And it's always been the case. And it's very much so still the case. And so there are times where that can be a real consideration for newsrooms.
I'm not going to go into the whole story because it's kind of circuitous, but I had the opportunity in 2018 to go to Tajikistan and talk to journalists there. That regime is, you know, it's sort of controlled by a family, and the pressure that is on journalists is actually sort of exerted economically, that you can't get stories published because news outlets are concerned, you know, that the government is going to lean on them or that there won't be resources available for them to publish. And so, you know, there are tons of journalists out there looking for ways to, you know, share news of value, you know, about healthcare and about, you know, education and things, not necessarily controversial, but the things that, you know, a normal newsroom would cover. And I was a little surprised by that. Maybe I shouldn't have been surprised, but it sort of opened my eyes to this idea that, especially for the local journalists, it's problematic, the environment with which they're trying to do their job and the limitations they're put under.
Mm. Oh, yeah. And that's increasingly, I think one of the dangers is that it's becoming less taboo to crack down on journalists. I mean, look what we're seeing in places like India, which had for years this incredibly robust, healthy, very, very vibrant media. You see the chilling effect of, I think the scariest thing is whenever there's, you know, a journalist's arrested or a, you know, a newsroom, a newspaper office is raided and a taboo has been broken and it doesn't really cause that much outrage. I think that's the scary thing. A lot of journalists, local journalists, are relying on people getting pissed off and the leadership of those countries getting nervous about what would it mean if we arrested this journalist and tossed them in jail. Or if we just started applying pressure, you know, would people care? I think that's the big calculation a lot of autocratic or, you know, autocratic curious governments around the world are having. And I worry that they're increasingly making the decision that people don't care.
Before we wrap up, I did want to ask you a little bit about your book, No Ordinary Assignment, a memoir. So what inspired you to write it that you thought, okay, I want to get this story down?
At the start of the book, I lay out, look, you know, I wanted to write a book about that really answered that question that everybody asks war reporters all the time. Like, why do you do this kind of work? And, you know, we're constantly asked, understandably. I think the answer very often is a half answer, which is, you know, this work is very important. You know, we believe in truth to power and there is nobility in this work. But the answer is also more nuanced. You know, what makes an individual do this work? What makes them good at this work? The answer can be complicated and not always flattering. You know, it can be the things that shape us, that make us want to know and understand this world, and that make us capable of operating at a high level in chaos. A lot of that can be personal. A lot of it comes down to where we've come from, who we are. A lot of it comes down to things that, you know, may not be considered assets in peacetime. <You know? laughs> We're a strange bunch at times. And I wanted to get under the skin of that and do that by being radically transparent about my life and how I ended up in conflict zones and how I ended up loving it and how I ended up feeling like this work was important. I wanted to answer those questions really honestly. And also touching on something that we've talked about, you know, people said, well, why now? Why did you want to write? Why would anybody in their 30s write a memoir? But the truth is, I was not writing a memoir about this fabulously successful career. I wanted to write a book about trying to become successful at international journalism. I grew up reading all these biographies and memoirs. I adored them. I inhaled them as a kid and a young journalist that, you know, sort of seemed like seamless ascents in careers. And I could start to see in the eyes of these youngsters watching me, oh my goodness, Jane Ferguson just won another DuPont and blah, blah, blah. And I could see them looking at me like I was some sort of magical unicorn. So I recognized it was time to write, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly, all of the rejections, all of the sleeping on sofas, all of the embarrassing failures. It was important to have that in there too, for that younger generation, I think, to see how the sausage is made in terms of a successful career and how much you're defined by your failures as well.
I would imagine when you first got into it, when you first moved to Yemen, that you were not living in a palace. You know, being a young journalist in another country, you're probably maybe in situations where a lot of people wouldn't necessarily be comfortable. So making people aware of that, that it's not all roses and candy, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. And not all glamorous. I mean, this idea of TV as well. A lot of cheese triangles for breakfast and, you know, just a ton of, I mean, you know, there's incidents in there with giant rats in Somalia and you know.
I think that's a famous Sherlock Holmes story, the giant rat of Sumatra, I believe.
Well, I'll check that out.
Anyway, Jane, thanks for coming on the podcast. This has been fascinating. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me on.
You've been listening to It's All Journalism, a weekly podcast about the people who report the news. You can find out more about us and download past episodes at itsalljournalism.com. While you're visiting our website, sign up for the It's All Journalism newsletter. To make sure you don't miss an episode of It's All Journalism, you can subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, SoundCloud, Google Play, Amazon, and pretty much anywhere good podcasts are found. If you'd like to help us grow our podcast, like and share our episodes on social media. Look for us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. It takes a lot of people to create an episode of It's All Journalism. Nicola Grisco is our audio producer. Amber Healy writes our web content. Amia Brust is our booking manager. Steph Thomas manages our social media. Nick Dupre composed our theme music. Carolyn Bilevsky designed our logo. And I'm your host, Michael O'Connell. Thanks for listening.